Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Happy New Year, podcastlings. It's the Nerdist Podcast number 52. Today's episode is with Mark Maron. Couple quick things up at the top, though. I want to tell you we are going to be doing Nerdist Podcast live in San Francisco at Cobb's Friday, January 28th, as part of SF Sketchfest, the ginormous three-week-long comedy festival in San Francisco. It's an incredible lineup this year. So go to sfsketchfest.com to get tickets to our show and see other shows. Also, I will be performing stand-up comedy jokes at Zany's in Chicago, February 16th through the 19th, and then at the Punchline in San Francisco again on March 2nd through the 5th. So that's all that information, and the boys and I packed it up and went over to the Cat Ranch to talk to Mark Maron just about his incredible success in the podcasting world and also about being a damn fine comedian. So here we go, the Nerdist Podcast episode number 52 with Mark Maron. Teeing up a good one for the start of the year.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
All right, are we recording? Your show, buddy.
Oh, my God. I love this. We are actually recording. This is the Nerdist Podcast. Chris Hardwick, Jonah Ray, Matt Myra. We are in the lair of Mark Maron.
The Cat Ranch.
We're at the Cat Ranch, which I don't know if... I'm sure this is going to... You're going to hear this the whole podcast, but basically the clouds are pissing...
The likes of which I have not seen in
Los
Angeles.
Not in a long time. I feel like the ceiling's just going to start crumbling like oatmeal into our lap.
No.
Are you turning the rain up, Mark? That's what it sounds like in my headphones.
Mark, turn the rain up.
It took to my mixer.
There was thunder? We never get thunder in Los Angeles.
Did you hear thunder?
Yeah,
we were
thunder.
Walking up.
See, maybe
wow.
I know people complain about it. They're like, you pussies. It's like 50 below here in Minnesota. And like, listen, LA is not built for rain. The streets are concave. They collect water. People don't know.
Nothing works.
Nothing works.
And people drive like
people
shit.
People don't know how to drive.
But it doesn't matter. Mark Maron, I'm thrilled that you're finally on my podcast. I did your podcast probably a year ago.
Yeah, we did. You did a live one, and I wanted to have you on for a long one, but I haven't. it's nothing personal.
I understand. I know how it works.
Well, no, sometimes I think like, well, Chris Hardwick, I like Chris Hardwick. What am I going to talk to him about for an hour? And then I think, oh, Chris Hardwick's doing okay on his own. I always have this idea about you that he's doing all right. He doesn't need to talk to me.
Oh, I love talking to you, though. I enjoy the camaraderie.
I'm really trying to focus, Chris. You got to understand, I've got two Bulgarian electricians in my house that have every light fixture in my house gutted. There are wires hanging everywhere. My cats are horrified. I just put the one cat that lives outside back outside so we won't kill the other cats. I have no idea where he's hanging out, so I feel guilty about that. I don't know if I can trust them. Al Madrigal just had to drop off a dimmer switch that these guys are going to install, and there's no end to the rain. I'm trying to keep it together, Chris.
Now, when did Al Madrigal start delivering hardware to people?
Well, Al Madrigal is my neighbor, along with Maria Bamford.
Bam.
Yeah, a couple other people. And Madrigal, of course, I told him that I had this electrical problem and that I had the Bulgarians over. And he said, oh, dude, you always got to check with me about workers. I got guys that'll work for good quality and cheap. I'm like, that's not going to help me now, Al. So
they're already here.
They're in my house and they've taken most of it apart.
Yeah. I mean, because we agree. I had said
you know, we could record this at my house. We could record it with G4. And you said, hey, I've never had this many people in my setup at once. Why don't you come over here and I'll try it out and see how it works?
I didn't realize I'd be dealing with so many obstacles, i.e. the second great flood, Bulgarians in my home. The things just, I was sitting at home last night and the lights just surged. Like, it was a feeling like, I think my house had an aneurysm. That's the only comparison I can make. Like, if I had an aneurysm, I would picture my brain would go, yeah, and then everything would shut down.
And so then your house smells like toast.
That's right. I smelled the toasty smell, and I called a 24-hour electrician. She said she was going to page a guy who never called me.
Of course.
And then I went into a mild panic, and then I realized, Chris, I'm an adult. These things happen to people. This is not I don't live in a shack.
Right.
You know, I'm not starving.
No.
I think if my smoke alarms work, I should be able to sleep.
I understand, but I'm going to go out on a limb here because I feel like we are a part of the fraternity of obsessively minded people. And when shit starts getting chaotic around your home,
yeah,
it is unsettling.
Yeah, unsettling. And also, it's very hard for me to not think that it indicates everything in my life. That is somehow... That this is just the arcing
just
of a wave.
Just an extension. Just an extension.
Because if one thing goes wrong, you know, I can just change my lens just a little bit, and sure enough, everything is going wrong.
I do the same thing. Somehow I make everyone's weather about me somehow. Yeah. Like, of course this is happening to me. Well, it's happening to everyone.
Right, a friend of yours calls in. It's like a horrible story about my father that I've told before. But this is a sad indication of what I come from. He calls me one day. And his wife's name is Rosie, and he says to me, he sounded sad. I said, what's the matter, Dad? Well, it's not unusual for him to be sad. He goes, well, we just found out Rosie's got breast cancer. And I said, that's horrible. I'm sorry to hear that. And then my dad says, yeah, I know. I got bad luck. So it's sort of an extreme and a sad indication of something, but nonetheless, it's like when someone else, it's very hard not to see shit going down the world and not personalize it. I'm trying not to, but there are a lot of things going wrong right now, Chris.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have a little brother.
You do have a little brother.
Yeah, he took the brunt of it.
Oh, he did? Yeah.
He did the best he could with me. As many of you know who have known me for years, it's no easy task. Oh, I'm sorry about that.
That's okay. We're pinging.
We're keeping the lines open.
Well, yeah, we're underwater now. It's finally happened. And fortunately, the garage is fortified.
One ping only.
A Russian Sean Connery has decided to defect his submarine, so we just have to keep tabs on him.
If he's defecting to Bulgarians, he's in luck because I have two in the house.
There are two in the house, and your house is floating. We are literally podcasting underwater.
This is like the start of a really bad Sid and Marty Krofft show. Where this podcaster is getting swept away in
water.
Did
you have to say really bad? I mean, I love Sid and Marty Krofft, which everyone. But not the highest quality of programming.
Yeah, okay. Sorry.
So someone in a big outfit can come out soon?
Yeah.
Like some giant puppet, a surprising puppet?
Yeah. Why, hello, podcasters.
How fantastic to be in a place where you can... I mean, Sid and Marty Krofft had the kind of weird power in television where they could be high on a beach, stare at a pile of seaweed, and go, that's a fucking show. And then it became a show.
And give him a name like Sigmund.
Sigmund.
Right, and then it would become anthropomorphized and lovable. Lovable pile of seaweed.
I worked on a cartoon once where the guy who ran it would want to anthropomorphize everything. And I always said, I was like, oh, I got an idea for one of the cartoon episodes. We'll have an anthropomorphized nothing.
Yeah.
So it's just like a blank space with eyes, arms, and legs, but with eyes, arms, and legs. That doesn't make sense.
Hasn't that been done, though? I feel like that's been done. Just the eyes, the floating eyes.
That's true. Yeah,
but usually
that's
after someone takes invisible cream
and puts it on. Yep.
And then puts a black hole on a wall and jumps right through it.
Yeah, but then the other guy just hits the wall.
Of course.
You don't want to get that on your eyes.
The antagonist will hit the wall. The protagonist gets to jump right through.
I call that personal physics.
That's how it works.
Customized. Just for me.
That's how it works.
Magic.
Whee!
Maren, it's been so much fun to watch everything that you've been doing. Like, your podcast... has exploded even since I did it just a year ago. I mean, I watched your show because I kept an eye on your show for a long time, especially before I started doing mine.
You mean, are you saying in a sort of an abstract way that you compulsively check your iTunes ranking?
I do check it sometimes. Yeah, I check the iTunes ranking probably once every 2 weeks.
The weird thing is about it doesn't indicate much of anything.
No, because it's a strange algorithm that they won't exactly tell you what it is, but I think it has to do with new subscribers versus subscribers you already have versus ratings.
Yeah, and comments or something.
And comments or something. So they because they try to keep the system fresh.
But it's I think the reason we get obsessed with iTunes is because you can see it.
Yeah.
So like, you know, people go to it. You're not going to explain why you're number 15 or something. Oh, it's because the algorithm. It's not a justified system of rating.
Right.
Anything.
Right.
But if you could stay somewhere visible, you're like, I'm winning.
Well, we need some kind
it's
of
like a credit score.
Yeah.
We need some kind of visible roadmap and so much of what we do. I mean, I was someone who always wanted to, like, I want to build a thing. I always love those montages of, like, guy builds a thing, someone accidentally sees it, then it becomes a product, then they build a factory, then it's a company, and then you can't really do that with art. Like, when you're doing stand-up, it's because you're the product, so it's very difficult to see
sure.
that.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah.
And to get that perspective, and so we have to take these weird little landmarks wherever we can get them, and that's that fucking rating system.
And as a comic, all you're seeing is that same arc of you getting old.
Like, yeah,
you
know, exactly.
You'd like to see the industry growing around you, but all you see is like, oh, fuck, is that Gray Temples? I got Gray Temples now? How do I sell that?
That didn't used to... Oh, there's younger kids out there. Well, just speaking about the rating system, Jonah emailed Matt and I, this is probably the best single comment that we have ever gotten. Someone gave us a 1-star review
by leaps and bounds
on iTunes. And by the way, I encourage you to give us 5-star reviews because that counts on our ranking system, and that's really important to everyone. Okay, so the subject of it was yeah.
Oh, but let's preface that we were in this episode he was referring to talking about.
Oh yeah, I had Mike Birbiglia on. We were podcasting him in his hotel, the W in Hollywood, and so we were shitting on the show Entourage, and I said, I've never gotten into Entourage because the characters are types of people that I've seen for decades in Hollywood, and I don't like those to hang out with those people, so I don't want to watch their story.
Yeah.
And so so we kind of shat on Entourage a little bit, not as a written show. It's a well-written show, but just the characters that I couldn't get behind. So this guy writes, yeah, .. 1-star by Martin 7044, December 7th, 2010. This is how I assume.
It's just yeah?
Yeah.
I got no.
I don't know how he talks, but this is how I read this in my head. This is how I heard him. I checked out this podcast, and they were talking about the TV show Entourage, and every character was a loser. Yeah, Ari, the most powerful agent in Hollywood, and Vincent, a millionaire actor. And who are these guys saying this? A bunch of dudes doing a podcast? Give me a break. So Jonah forwards it to us going, I think this guy thinks Entourage is a documentary.
Right, those are real guys.
Take it personally. Like, Ari's a loser. He's only the most powerful agent in Hollywood.
When he gets a hold of you guys, you're going nowhere.
Yeah, good luck trying to get a career now.
I'll give you guys are cooler than Turtle, but other than that.
Well, isn't that weird, though? Because I find that a lot, even with intelligent people, that they have this weird blind side to how things are really done and what reality is and what it isn't. It's fucking ridiculous to me. Like, there are people that still think that Jon Stewart writes his own jokes all the time.
Right.
That, like, when the writer's strike happens, I was baffled that people weren't like, oh, see, they don't. They're just acting. They have people. But no, they intelligent people really believe. You know, sir, I'm not saying that guy was intelligent.
No.
But I do like what you were saying about those type of people that seem to have a very specific type of fun that everyone understands involves, you know, money and power and fast cars and strippers is not really the type of fun we have, so we hate them. We've been battling with that type of person for centuries.
Well, because it is, I guess within the entertainment business, it is a very... The structure of it is very jocks versus nerds. I mean, there is like those types of Entourage guys who can walk into a bar and scoop up 4 coked up models, and someone like me would walk into a bar and be like, hello, like I want to make weird references to, you know, to Doctor Who, and I will scare those types of people away.
Well, let's be honest, Chris. If I could, and I know I'm sitting in my old chair, and I'm trying to let you drive your own show here.
No,
but let's be honest. That I think that in your heyday, you've had your experience with coked up models. I mean, you
I did not.
Never.
No. Nope.
All right. But okay. So the thing that I'm
a serial monogamist. I've been in pretty much serious relationships my whole life.
That's the weird thing. I have though. I have had my entire.
You've got a great story. Have you told that on the Nerdist?
No, I know.
Okay. All right. Well, you can keep that a secret as long as you want, Jonah. I'm not gonna
just you, me, and the improv lab. That's all that.
Oh, Jesus.
Jonah's heart is like inside, he has an inner rock and roll motherfucker.
Oh, yeah,
no, there's definitely like, and I know you do too, Chris.
Nah.
I've heard you sing Zeppelin. I mean, come on,
that means
monogamy's one thing. But I mean, I've seen you fucking sing Zeppelin. And also, what I'm saying is that if they just went to the next day, is that all that glory of coked up models and running around in nightclubs, the morning after is always ugly. You don't know when the coked up model is going to leave. You don't know if she's going to live through the night. You don't know. You know, there's a lot of things.
You don't know if the steroid shot you drove into her heart's going to get a beating again.
Exactly. So all this enchantment is based on pure horseshit. I mean, I don't really understand how people idealize this kind of stuff because
you lived it. You lived it, right?
Yeah, but I was, you know, I'm not necessarily a nerd, but I'm socially awkward at heart. And, you know, so whatever I lived, you know, I unfortunately, what I'm noticing in my life is I like people that like me. Mm-hmm. And that's not always the best policy. I think that you should fight a little bit and try to charm, you have to go after something.
Sure.
So my experience with coke and everything else and all that rock and roll living was I saw all that stuff going on and I was hanging around with people that did it, but I never felt like I was really part of it. I didn't have much game.
Okay.
So it wasn't, I wasn't living the life.
I like what you just said about you have to fight a little bit to get those relationships. Who is someone that you saw and you're like, I want that guy to like be friends with me? Who?
Oh shit, dude! I mean, people that we know. You mean? I mean, it's always been the way with me. I'm doing a lot of reading on my own psychological sickness lately. I recently went through a breakup of my own device. That I really am sad that I had to do it. You know, it was just that I realized that my problems, I somehow or another, since the divorce, I thought over the last 3 or 4 years that I magically became not angry anymore and well-adjusted. Right. Like, I have this thought, there's this part of my brain that thinks like, hey, maybe I could understand chemistry now, even though I got a fucking F in it in high school, that like, I'm older now. It should be easy. But, none of that shit happens.
I think but from my perspective, and I hope this isn't insulting, because it's not like you and I talk every day, so I maybe I don't know what I'm talking about. I feel like you have come a tremendous.
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely. But the question about when I was younger, and I think what evolved into my sort of aggressive personality that alienated a lot of people was that I'm the kind of guy like I need one friend, mm-hmm. and that's a tough job to be my one friend. It's a very demanding job, and it's draining.
You
quite
bring
honestly,
bring out dimmer switches in the rain. Sure,
yeah that's just a neighbor's job. Imagine his friend's job.
But the thing was, is like Dave Cross is a great example. When we were starting out, and he was like, he was always pretty cool and goofy and funny, but he was also pretty sociable and seemed to have a lot of friends. Like I wanted nothing more than to be, Dave Cross's friend. Back in. Like, it must have been 89, mm-hmm. 88, 89. And I'd met him in college, and I wanted to be his friend. And I felt like I worked really hard to be Dave Cross's friend, and he eventually let me. And and it worked out pretty well. But all these people that have these experiences with me, they all see me as this really kind of like aggressive, angry, needy person. And I'm always like, but we were such good friends. And then I realized in retrospect, it's like, I had no choice. you were basically stalking me.
You strong-armed me into friendship.
I was emotionally coerced by your insanity.
But you were the only person, I know I said this on your podcast, but it was a long time ago. You were the only person who could attack someone and then disarm them at the same time, because you would say something horrible and then reveal a horrible insecurity of your own. Yeah. You go. You think what you're doing up there is good? Fucking get a life. I only say that because I'm insecure and I didn't get hugged a lot when I was a kid. You're like, yeah. I don't know how to feel now.
Yeah.
So don't know how to feel.
So you're saying I'm sort of like an emotional rapist.
Well, in a way, because it's all about power. You would manage to go in and attack and then get the counterattack. You would take control of that too.
Yeah, so. You punch someone in the face and go, help me.
Exactly. It was gorgeous.
Well, I'm doing a lot of reading about that now, Chris, and I'm starting to understand myself a little better. Now, if I can maybe these Bulgarians can rewire my fucking brain while they're here, because that would be helpful.
It's possible, although the gift that many comedians have is that you become so hyper-aware of everything and every little thought, every little feeling, every nerve impulse that it becomes difficult to discern, like, what's normal, what's abnormal, like what you just normally have but you didn't pay attention to before, so you don't know if it's
right. Here's an indicator. Here's a couple indicators. They're not laughing or she's crying. You know that. So
those are two very
red flags of not normal, or at least not doing
it. It's worse when it's all at the same time, though. When everyone's laughing, yeah.
It's like the audio, or worse is, or and better, the real horror show is like, hey, they're all laughing but she's crying, and I'm the one with the mic. That happened in Bloomington, Indiana.
Oh, the Comedy Attic?
Less than a year ago.
You were at the Comedy Attic?
I was.
I enjoyed the Comedy Attic.
It's great.
It's a good town.
He's a good guy. I have to remind myself to get in touch about that fucking hotel. I'm not staying at that hotel again.
Oh, that one that's out on that weird highway?
I never felt more unsafe in a hotel in my life. You know, aside from, you know, I'd also sort of met a slightly crazy person that I, of course, befriended. But there was that hotel. It's like out in the middle of nowhere, and it's a cottage hotel where you get a key to a little like house.
Like a townhouse kind
right,
of thing.
But there's no security. The keys are like these ancient punch hole keys. I just never felt more unsafe in a situation. I need to stay at the fucking Hilton in town.
I'll tell you, it's worth it to, I mean, even now when I go on the road, even if I end up paying out of pocket, I will pay to stay in a nicer hotel because it is so fucking worth it to me.
Oh, dude, it's like that was one of those monumental sad things where like I was at that hotel and I didn't have a car and it's you're not close to any fucking coffee shop and I didn't go shopping to, you know, to have my little stash of shit in the fridge and I wanted a coffee in the morning and all they had was like Swiss Miss cocoa packets and some packaged coffee. So I'm like, all right, so I'm going to make a mocha with this. So I'm sitting there like some sort of ridiculous road chemist, you know, trying to make a mocha that'll get me up enough to enjoy my day. And it was tragic in a way.
And you almost become a pioneer. I better trudge out to the coffee well, bring in more coffee. I'll be back in 4 hours.
Oh, the things that I try to manufacture to replace ice cream, it's sort of sad. I'm in there, like, I make my own flavored yogurt. I'm not proud of this, but, like, I've gotten to this point where I know what I like. I'm fairly specific, and if I can manufacture something that is as close to buying shit, like, I get this Trader Joe's plain non-fat yogurt. I put stevia in it, and I put either vanilla flavoring or almond flavoring, and this is really fucking, it's not even nerdy, it's just bizarre. When I was a kid in New Jersey, very young, at my grandma's house, I really loved Dannon coffee yogurt.
Uh-huh.
They made a coffee flavored yogurt, and now I've taken my chemistry to create my own coffee yogurt. I went to Sur La Table, which I have that part of my life because I have a SodaStream seltzer maker, and I bought coffee flavoring, and I think I've mastered the coffee yogurt. And I'm not saying I deserve any sort of fanfare, but I'm satisfied, and I just wanted to share that. I'm a little embarrassed.
So. I think you would be doing your fans a great service if you would post the recipe online. I think people would love to enjoy Mark Maron's coffee flavored
yogurt.
Here's
how I make non-fat yogurt. I take plain yogurt, you know, usually Trader Joe's, or anything that's non-fat completely, and I sweeten it with stevia, which is this weird root that I'm sure I hope that in the long haul it's not bad for me. Yeah, I know aspartame is bad.
People say that stevia is the really organic healthy people say stevia is the new way to go.
Right, but if you get pure stevia, it's very powerful. You know, it's like blow. It's like you better do a taste test. You know, like cut it or don't kill yourself. You know, just do a small hit, and then I take flavoring and I mix it into the yogurt, and that's how I make non-fat yogurt. And I, of course, am, and I know about this stuff. I come from a family of eating disorders. So there you go.
There's a new fake sweetener I saw a commercial for. I can't remember what it was called, but it's supposed to be the Splenda replacement.
Splenda, I heard, causes anal leakage. So that is not something, I know that it's important to look thin, but how important is it?
All of it's bad, you know. Like that's the thing, like I drink a lot of Cherry Coke Zero. That's my favorite soda right now.
Yeah.
And I know just like in a few, I drink it a lot because I know nobody has figured out why it gives you cancer.
So you're just trying to stay ahead of the cancer curve?
Yeah, exactly.
I think Diet Cherry Coke's better than Cherry Coke Zero.
Well, the aspartame thing, there's a sort of like a borderline conspiracy theory about aspartame causing similar symptoms to MS and causing memory loss, that there are certain people that have a allergic reaction to aspartame, and then that's traced back to Donald Rumsfeld, who was at Searle Pharmaceutical at the time that they invented aspartame, and he pushed it through, so somehow it's tied to 9/11. I mean, it's a big conspiracy.
And it all goes to
Dr. Xavier could handle this.
He could send in the X-Men.
You know why I like hanging out with nerds?
Xavier.
As I don't know what you're talking about.
Please, we're in the fight. Like, if I could just describe the room we're in, it's just like...
With the Watchmen.
You got Watchmen right there. Yeah. Like, we're in a library. It's awesome. There's books stacked everywhere. I mean, look, I see a book of ape men, which I assume is some sort of book about the development of hominids.
I stole that from the Creation Museum. No, that's a book.
Did you really?
Yeah.
You stole that from the Creation? Why? Yeah,
I did.
That when you open it, does it say like, thanks, Lord?
Well, basically, it's basically trying to prove that that any association between men and apes is ridiculous. It's basically trying to prove that the ape man idea is false. And I stole it from the...
Well, you shouldn't have to pay for that.
I know, right, the bargain table. Yeah, it's fucking a book of lies. Yeah. So I should have it for free.
Just like all fiction books.
Yeah.
It's nothing. It is a book physically, but it's nothing, so it should be free.
But it's entertaining to know that there are people, like, you know, sweating over that going, of course, how clear does it have to be that this is, you know, we are special God-made things.
I don't throw my own feasties. I must not be.
You
them.
Want me to write this book about ape men, but I'm not a scientist. Even better.
Is this the Creationist Museum, the Pee-wee's Big Adventure dinosaurs out on the way to Palm Springs?
No, this is one that's in Kentucky. I can't remember where it is, but they're building an ark there. Building a scale model of the ark, which a lot of people think, you know, what a display. But I think they're actually preparing.
They should move it to Los Angeles, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm building one today.
But you know the dinosaurs from the dinosaur scene like the Brontosaurus has been turned into a creationist store.
What?
Yeah, you go inside a dinosaur.
Do you have any dreams? Yes, I'm all alone. I'm rolling a big donut, and there's a snake wearing a vest. That's now taken over.
It's now a creationist shop where you can get coloring books of Jesus riding a dinosaur and stuff like that.
For irony purposes, right?
No.
I bought a snow globe, a creation snow globe with a little dinosaur with somebody like riding it or something.
I mean,
they wouldn't let me take it on the plane.
Oh, really? Why? Yeah.
Because
so much liquid in there. There's a lot of liquid.
You could attack someone with your creationist snow globe.
Well, they thought it was going to blow up. And I said, it's much more dangerous to be in circulation with people.
The truth is going to blow up.
Not only do they presuppose that we were around when dinosaurs were around, but that we tamed them. Like, that's how
Well, anyone who watches the Flintstones knows.
Would know that, obviously.
But, Mark, it's interesting because I had been writing, I was trying to write a bunch of, creationist. Material, and then I saw you at UCB one night, and you pretty much did everything that I would want to say. And I'm like, well, I don't need to develop this any further.
Oh, you saw me do the chunk on the museum?
I don't know if it was a chunk on the museum, but it had something to do with like the thing that I was writing was there's this idea of irreducible complexity where they say like, well, they use it to explain creationism where they say like specifically, well, this system that you have that where you see like your sight system. Yeah. If you were to, you can't reduce that any farther. Like, it couldn't have evolved.
Oh, okay.
Because it is as simple as it could possibly be.
They've got a lot of weird nooks and crannies of pseudoscience.
It had to be creative, right.
Yeah.
And so I was, my point was like, hey, you know, if you go back in history when religion, politics, and science were all the same thing, if you just looked at a frog, you would say, well, that's as simple as that thing's going to get. We can't. And then you open it up and go, oh, no, there's pieces inside. And now we can look at things on a subatomic level. And, you know, so it was just the idea of like, you know, you see certain religious bodies have to keep ebbing their beliefs to meet with science. But it's rare that you ever see the other side. And what you said was, why aren't people just comfortable saying we don't fucking know yet? And that was it so succinctly described what I was trying to say that I gave up on all the material.
Wow, and I don't even remember saying that.
You have to write that down.
Well, I ended up doing like 15-20 minutes on my trip to the Creation Museum for my new CD that like I started doing. I was in Cincinnati and I started talking about just the experience of it and how I thought I would be a lot more angry. But really, I was so amazed at how much money and how amazing the museum was that I really wasn't angry, but I was like gloriously embarrassed for our country, but somehow proud because I knew that this couldn't happen anywhere else.
Were you performing at the Funny Bone? And
I was working at I was in Cincinnati at Go Bananas.
Oh, okay, all right.
Which was great. I had a great time there. It's been fun to go on the road and actually, you know, people come out to see me specifically.
Isn't that a joy?
After 25 years, yeah.
Is it interesting? Is it interesting to you that because I find that the podcast
has brings more people to live shows than all of the TV stuff I've ever done put together.
Yeah, well, I mean, like you, but not so much. I mean, I think you were actually more popular than me in your specific job on TV at different points in your career. But, you know, it was hard for me because there was this idea I had after doing as much, you know, comedy on TV, you know, Conan's and, you know, Premium Blends, or not Premium Blends, but Comedy Central Presents, HBO specials, that after 20 years of really not building an audience, that I had this idea that it was only because that America had decided that you know, the jury was in, no Marin, that there was some sort of thought out there that not only was it, I wasn't...
Foreman, have you reached a verdict?
Exactly, and the verdict
what
was
What do
in,
you that, think? Yeah. What do you think?
And the truth of the matter is, you don't, if anyone could manufacture that lightning in a bottle that causes someone to take off or not take off. You know, who knows how it happens or why the kids like something or why anybody pops through into the collective unconscious or the collective consciousness, that, you know, I was pretty beaten down by it. But the interesting thing about this is I'm doing it in my garage, my podcast. This is your podcast. And I have no control over who gets. I don't know really who's going to get it. But I do know that the people that are coming out know me.
Right.
It's not about my comedy. Like, a lot of times they're like, yeah, I heard some of that stuff. You talked about it before. And they start asking you about, like, well, did you ever get, how's the cats? You know, so that the dialogue is like, they're literally hanging out with a guy they listen to once or twice a week. You know, so the dynamic is different. It's not just about, we want to see your comedy. Like, afterwards, you know, they bring me gifts. I get boxes. I get cakes. A lot of people bring me very peculiar things.
It's great. And I think one of the reasons, and I mean, I don't mean to get slobbery, but one of the reasons why you're one of my favorite performers is because you manage to do a thing which I still feel like I'm maybe 10 years away from, which is you manage to put your persona... Like, you're an open book on stage. You are as much who you really are on
right.
stage than really almost any other performer I can think of.
Well, I wouldn't say, I would try to tell you to, I discourage you from, you know, taking 10 years to try to get to that place, because, you know, ultimately, you know, there's a dynamic that people expect at a show, and that's he's the performer. So, you know, some of that, because of the way I've gone at it, is lost. You know, like, I have no real respect for a fourth wall, and I do obviously have bits that I do, but there's not much distance between me. I've always envied people that have a persona. I'm like, what? When is mine going to show up? You know, when
right.
is my persona going
right.
to show up? Because in my mind, and I realize it more now because of the reading I'm doing, that, you know, all I've really been trying to do is be myself in all areas of my life, and that's what I do on stage. So for me, the whole journey was not about how do I become some sort of weird amplification of my own insanity
right.
so I feel safe within it. How do I build a clown that works? And because the problem with the way I do it is that every fucking show is emotionally draining. Like, I don't have any sense of autopilot. If I'm on autopilot, like if I feel myself for whatever reason detaching from my audience, I literally say, God damn it, I don't want to do this joke anymore. I got to get into the present. So if that's part of my act and people go, I love when Marin does that, it's like, well, that's just Marin trying to fucking emotionally get present and risk being drained, you know, by the end of the show. So it's a very exhausting way to work. More disciplined performers who build an act and have a persona that they can write for, you know, might actually, you know, after a show, feel elated as opposed to
a protective wall between their material and themselves.
Right, right. Yeah. As opposed to get off stage going, I can't believe I told them that. I don't fucking know them. Like, as if it's not going to get back to somebody. I'll do shows where I say shit where I'm like, I literally have to say, could you guys not tweet that? Because, like, I'm still involved in that situation. You know, like, it's ridiculous.
Well, you managed to... I saw you have a really good set at the Laugh Factory one night, which...
Holy shit, I hardly ever worked there.
Exactly. And the reason being is because it is a place where big, you know, kind of big personas prevail.
Yeah.
And when you were on stage, you were just sitting on a stool just talking about yourself, but it was working with them, and it was so incredible to me because I'm like, wow... This is, if I felt like I saw more of this working at the Laugh Factory, I would probably want to perform more
there. Well, it's very tricky with that because I know now, and I didn't know for years, you know, the limitations of the way I do comedy, which is that, and I was a guy that started, you know, 15 years into my career was very aggressive. You know, I had that sort of first joke that I knew would pop it open, and then I'd stay in that, and, you know, and I was strutting around the stage and sweating and smoking and yelling. You know, I was a big persona. But I started to feel very trapped in it, and I realized, like, you know, I'm posturing. So the trick of performing like the way I perform now, it's almost like I like to get on stage sometimes and just literally be like, oh, fuck, I don't know. I don't know. And then all of a sudden people like are paying, you had to get them to pay attention in a different way than they've had, you know, whoever went before you or whatever 10 acts they've shown. That's the frightening risk of doing it the way I do it, is that I have to turn the channel, you know, and not just with energy, you know, like sometimes you try to jump into someone else's energy and like, oh, I'm just going to stay at the pace that you guys are used to. And here we go. Or when they bring you up to music, like, ka-ding, ding, pa, and you're like, well, I can't even fucking follow the segue music. And like, so what I've been doing now is literally be as confused and disjointed as possible in the first few minutes, just so they'll listen differently.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been a trick, and I learned that lesson early on when I was in, and I didn't abide by it, but when I was first starting out in Boston, I was at Nick's Comedy Shop, and it must have been like 89, 88, and they gave me a 5-minute guest spot right after Dennis Leary. And Dennis Leary, you know, in his heyday, you know, whether he did well or not, was going to just blow the room open because of his, you know, manic intensity and his pace. So, like, he gets off, and I tried to jump right into that, and I bombs. And I just felt a vacuum. Like, it wasn't even that they weren't enjoying me. It was like they were taking something from my soul.
Right.
There was a vacuum to the silence. And I realized that, you know, you can't really do that. A couple of things you should never do as a comic is try to jump on the groove of the guy before you or take a shot at him as he goes out just to get your first laugh. And I've done that before, and I think we've all done that, you know, like you get up and like, oh, I guess Marin is just meh, meh, meh. And of course that was Patton doing it, or Jimmy Pardo, but
oh no sir, yeah. Oh no sir, definitely not.
I asked him again last night. I saw Pardo at I did the Benson's I Love Movies. He had this massive, like, it was a 12 person elimination of the Leonard Maltin game, so it was like Sarah and Patton and Kevin Pollak and Paul F. It was just like a big giant round table, and I saw Pardo there, and I was like, Pardo, I'm gonna ride you. We're gonna do the mega podcast. You, me, Marin, Carolla, Ackerman, we're all gonna get together and do it. And he's like, that is the worst idea I've ever heard in my life. I will never do that. I will never be on board for that. Awful.
Yeah. Yeah, because Pardo would not be able to talk as much as he's used to talking in that particular situation. I mean, when you're working with Pardo, you literally have to start talking like him in order to get a word in edgewise.
He wouldn't even tell me why. Like, you're going like, but why? What is the why? It would be fun. It'd be like a big, you know, Laugh Olympics of podcasts. Oh no. Why? I can't get it out of him.
And to add to my impression of him that seemed attacking or insensitive, I'd like to say that one of the nicest guys in the world, Jimmy Pardo.
Heart of gold.
See, I still do it, Chris. I still, like, you know.
But he is.
No, I love him. He helped me out a lot. I met
Don Rickles at a party the other night, and it was sort
how
of
do
like,
you accidentally meet Don Rickles?
Because,
like, holy shit,
I'll tell you exactly.
We're in the bathroom at the same time.
I'll tell you exactly how, and it's going to get name-droppy, and I apologize, but this was just a
really
situation.
Do you really apologize, Chris?
I really do, actually.
I've only listened
really
to your podcast
do.
A few times, and
I really
sense there is some name droppage.
It's
generally.
Not, but it gives context to the story. Okay, I won't say who.
Don't apologize for something you always do, Chris.
Oh, jeez, Mark Maron. Oh, jeez.
Go ahead, I just dropped your name twice.
Sideswiped on my own podcast. So I was saying goodbye to someone at this party, and they were talking to Don Rickles. And I was like, oh, I don't want to interrupt. I just want to say goodbye. He's like, no, come here. And Don was like, they tell me you're a comedian. And I'm like, I am. And so he just started talking about comedy. And I was perched at his side like I was listening to my grandfather tell a Christmas story. He was like, I mean, by the way, I'm working on the Don Rickles podcast. I don't know if it's going to happen. I don't know if it's going to happen.
And did he say, okay, listen, hockey puck.
He did not say hockey puck, but he was so sweet, but he was just like, it's all attitude. It's all attitude. I mean, it doesn't matter. I don't even know if I've written jokes. If I'm on a show and I hand someone $5 and I go, here, go buy a real shirt. It's just because of the attitude. It's not what I'm saying. And me and this other guy were just sitting there with our mouths agape. I couldn't even speak.
Yeah.
Because we were getting this.
Well, that's a nice encounter with a veteran. I once was introduced to Jackie Mason by Rick Newman, who used to own the old Catch Rising Star in New York.
And, name drop.
Yeah, and Rick Newman said, hey, Jackie, this is Mark Maron. He's a young comedian. And Mason looks at me and goes, doesn't look funny. And that was the end of that court session. It's a very short holding court.
In fairness, Jackie Mason does look hilarious.
Yeah, well, a lot of guys, there's a long tradition of people that look hilarious. I mean, that use that element. Like Chris and I don't know that I think I'm getting more hilarious looking as I get older. And only, you know, and I'm not inviting it, but Chris doesn't look hilarious. He looks svelte and, you know, focused. And you know, like some sort of like, you know, nerd ferret up there.
Yep, that's right. Jumping around.
Someone make that drawing. Someone chives. Draw that. Chris as a ferret doing
nerd
comedy.
Ferret on stage. Already happened. Somebody will.
It's already
somebody
happened.
Will.
Yeah, I don't mean, like, do I need to apologize to you for anything?
No.
Are we good?
We're right. Totally good. No, we're good. I asked you out to lunch like 2 years ago, and you're like, why? What are you going to, are you going to attack me? Like, no, I just want to, like, I feel like you're one of those guys that, you know, that I respect their work. And so I just kind of wanted to get to know you a little bit better. And there was just like, and you were, at the very beginning, your instant response was defensiveness. But then after that, we had a nice lunch.
Well, that was because, like, you know, I'm a jealous guy. You know, what can I tell you? And I, you know, and John Lennon wrote a song about it. So I'm valid in my, But I think that at some point, like, I always decided that you were one of those guys that was always doing well, and anybody who I assume is always doing well, I take issue with. And but then, like, you know, there was that period there where you're sort of chubby and sweaty
and you were the person that I came to. We were at a party.
It was
Zach Galifianakis was having a 4th of July party
in Venice,
2003. I remember because I was so hammered at that party that I had called a cab and then passed out on Zach's floor.
Yeah, he was like Chris was the guy that was on the floor. Like, there's no moment worse for a guy who drinks than the moment where you're just, you know, unconsciously on display. Like, you're like, I'd like to introduce you to my problem while I
while I'm in your way. Yeah, you have to step over my problem.
That was the best part because you were right next to the couch.
Oh, you were there.
Yeah, I was there. And you're right next to the couch.
And so
almost made it.
And Zach had to wake me up and go, your cab's here. And it was one of those, where am I? Like that. I didn't know where I was. But I think, you know, an hour or so before that, that's when I really started to sense, like, this lifestyle is maybe not working for me. I mean, I was going up on stage and just, like, blanking. I couldn't, you know, like, any presupposition of, oh, alcohol, like, being fucked up frees your mind on stage, it completely emptied my mind. And so I was starting to feel like, this is not working, and I think I might need to talk to someone. And you were the first person that I came to at that party, and I was like, so you don't drink anymore, right? Yeah. Beer in hand, drooling.
As Mark is outside shooting people with fireworks.
Yeah, shooting people with Roman candles.
You and Nick Swartz.
Oh, that was the greatest time. Like, they had like $10,000 worth of fireworks. Yeah.
You got so excited when you found them, too.
Dude, I couldn't stop. I was like 7. And we're just like burning shit up. And who's that other guy? Houses. Who's Nick's friend? The other comic? I think he's like a Midwestern guy, a portly guy.
Oh,
a soft-spoken dude.
Yeah. It was Dixon
just,
Matthews.
Yeah,
it was, yeah,
Dixon, and it was just like, it was fucking hilarious, you know. And I think I was married at the time, and everyone was looking at us like we were like fucking idiots. And I think we did some real damage to his concrete. It was a very cute little house, and you know when you do the firework that you're like, and it burns, it literally burns the concrete because of the magnesium content, and you have that moment where you're like, I think we really fucked that up. That's not going to wash off. I think there was a lot of that.
There could have been
and
some
it was
of
a
that.
Small street, small crowded Venice street, with just cars and kids were around. Too.
So in the middle of this fucking firework apocalypse, portly Hardwick comes out to me all sweaty and confused with his beer. Like, I think I'm in trouble.
So you've been sober for a while. At that point, you probably were sober for about 5 years or so, 6 years maybe.
Yeah.
And we talked about it for a second, and then I think I ran into you, I don't know, a week or two later at the Improv, and you came up to me and you handed me the sheet, and you're like, look, here's a questionnaire.
Did I? Wow. Did.
Here's a questionnaire. Fill it out. It might answer some questions for you as to whether or not you might have a problem. But it was hilarious that you reminded me. You're like, I'm not just doing this for you. This shit helps me too. Like, helping other people helps me. Yeah, yeah. So I want you to know there's a selfish aspect of it as well.
Well, that's because I was really program-minded. And I don't know, did it help you?
It did, because because what people have to understand, the context of our relationship up to that point was, you were very aggressive toward me. And so the fact that you would go out of your way as someone that I was convinced hated me to say, look, despite whatever there might be between us, I maybe you should take a look at this.
Yeah.
Like, that made it that gave it that much more weight to me as opposed to someone who's my friend, where it's like, you know, it's like your mom complimenting you.
Sure.
Like, of course you're going to say that.
Yeah.
But for someone who hates my guts to go, look, dude, I think I see some similarities here, and maybe you should fucking think about this. That you may have been, a large part of the reason why I quit drinking.
Well, I'm glad I didn't get too like heavy-handed with the AA shit because, like, I mean, you chose another option, and a lot of people, you know, don't realize that there are other options. And I, you know, obviously what worked for me, you know, is not going to work for everybody. But like, I think I tried to get you to a couple meetings at some point, but you're like, you thought about it, and you might have gone to one or two, but like then I saw you like 6 months later, and you're like, I'm running like 900 miles a day, you know. So you completely replace the alcohol with this running thing. I'm like, you look great. If it's working, fuck it.
Well, I used vanity to help fuel my sobriety. Mm-hmm. And then of course later on I had all the realizations of like, oh, this is why I was doing this. And
those never stop.
No. but it was interesting because I realized about myself that vanity was a gateway to, you know, like, because I lost a lot of weight right away and I started living healthier. And so the fact that I looked better made me go, oh, okay, now this is something I should do.
Right.
Then, like I said, years later through therapy and whatever, I realized like, oh, well, there are a lot of other really more important reasons
you got a
why
good
you
therapist?
Shouldn't do that. Yeah, I had an amazing therapist when I quit drinking. It was Billy Connolly's wife. Is a therapist, and I went to her.
Who's got the name dropping scorecard?
Were you just asking about Billy Connolly the whole time? Was that your therapy?
No, but the reason that I
did she talk like him? You've got a problem. We must deal with this.
The reason that I went to her is because you know I loved Billy Connolly. I didn't know him, but I worked with him once, and he was really sweet, and I was a fan of his comedy, and I assumed. If she is married to a comedian, and she also was a comedian, she was on SNL in the 80s.
Uh-huh.
Her name is Pamela Stevenson. I thought she understands the comic brain.
Is she still in the game?
No, she left to go write a book, and she went on sabbatical, and like, but she was the person that I went into when I was like, it was like 2 months after that happened.
Yeah,
and she just looked at me, and she was like. You look terrible. You look awful. You're blotchy. You look homeless. You need to go into like you need to. She's British, so she was very eloquent the way she was saying it. She's like, you need to stop today. And I don't know, for whatever reason, just after having talked to you and a couple other people and just her words, like right then, I was like. I guess I could just do this today.
Yeah.
And that's what it was.
Well, you did look, it's interesting because like you were one of those guys, not like me, you know, I'd get very gregarious and I'd make an ass out of myself and be angry and shit. But like you had that look where you're like, you had that look in your eye, like you didn't know where you were anymore.
Oh,
you're
yeah.
like disjointed that you had this gaze where it was just sort of, you were constantly assessing your entire life or something. And you're looking at the battlefield of your life at all times, like some weird thousand yard stare from a war in your head.
Yep.
And I'm glad you found her. Billy Connolly is amazing. I had one of the most intense breakfasts in my life. And at the Aspen Comedy Festival, I somehow was wandering around the buffet in the morning years ago. And I was doing my one-man show up there. And I see him and he looks at me and he goes, oh, you're the whatever he said. I don't remember, but I sat down and that guy, he just radiates his fucking charisma. I thought I was going to disintegrate while I was eating my omelet.
Like
just
blast radius.
Yeah, because like you watch him on stage and then you realize like even when you're in a room watching him, he's very huge, you know, in terms of presence. But that doesn't change when you're eating breakfast with him. And he like literally is like, I think I need to sit at the other table. But we're still having breakfast together, even if there's, you know, even if sad Steve Martin is sitting over to the left by himself. We're still going to try to maintain the connection and have breakfast together.
Oh, that's hilarious. What was it for you that, I mean, did you go to rehab? I mean, do you talk about that stuff? What did you?
Oh, yeah, I talk about it exclusively. What was it for me?
Yeah, what was it for you?
Well, I was, I was in a miserable marriage. My career was in the toilet. I was doing, you know, small segments for a local TV show in New York City where I wandered around the streets with a desk, you know, talking to people. I thought it was over. This was one of the many junctures in my career where I was, you know, pretty broke and my life had gotten away from me. And I was sweaty and drunk and fat and holding court at the Comedy Cellar. And fucking Mishnah Wolf appeared like some sort of angel and said, I know you. You're Marc Maron. What happened to you?
Oh.
And I'm like, what? She goes, you look like you're going to die. And I'm like, who are you, pretty girl?
Is that when you went, fuck you, let's get married? Is that when you proposed?
A few weeks later. She basically said, well, I can help you out and I can lead you in the right direction. I'm like, I'll go anywhere you want. Yeah, and then, of course, I followed her for 8 or 9 years until that blew up. But nonetheless... That was the moment. And I'd been in before. I was in rehab in, you know, 1987 or 88.
Before
for a month.
Cool.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, it, you know, it held for a year or so. And, you know, I'd been struggling with it to some degree, but I never quite understood or thought that right. I had that big a problem. And somehow or another, she got through to me, and I just grabbed onto her and drained her of her life force until she had to aggressively detach from me and go somewhere else.
Did you steal her essence? I listened to the Dane Cook podcast.
No, I didn't steal her essence, but I imposed my essence on her pretty heavily.
I have to tell you, by the way, I thought the Dane Cook podcast that you did was phenomenal. Like, and what's interesting about your niche in all of the little podcast verse is that you like, because some people have said, like, well, why don't you try to get Dane Cook on your podcast? And because I feel like, because Mark did the perfect interview with him. Like, I don't feel like I can.
It's weird that that sort of set some weird standard. That a couple of things happened with that podcast is that I didn't know what to talk to him about. And I don't, you know, he doesn't fill a very large part of my brain.
Right.
And I never was, outside of the fact, you know, that you know, I was quoted as saying this, that he seems to not have a lot of substance, but he has a lot of, you know, very charismatic energy that kids get a kick out of. But, you know, he's sort of an empty vessel filled with gasoline, I think is what I called him in so many words. That I thought he was indicative of something happening culturally that was disturbing. But I was never one of these guys that, you know, that gets hung up on who stole what and whatever.
Right, right, right.
But I didn't know really what I was going to talk to him about. And it was interesting because I get this phone call. Bill Bird had put it in his ear to do my podcast and gave him my number, I think, is how it worked. And I'm walking down the street in San Francisco. I'm up there doing a gig. And I get this call and my phone rings. I don't know what the number is. And I go, hello? And all I hear is, Mark, it's Dane Cook. And I'm like, wow, it never stops, really, the intensity? Like, yeah.
And you mentioned that to me. Yeah. He was like, I did?
Yeah. Well, the thing was, is I think he'd listened. Like, he does his homework. He's a fairly political guy. You know, he's very aware of his image and what he wants out of things. And so I didn't, and I just, you know, quit nicotine, you know, the day or two before that. And I was relatively aggressive with him. And it worked to his favor. You know, I wasn't calling him out on shit, but I think my approach was like, you know, why does everyone think you're such an asshole? And like, I just asked the questions I thought people would want to hear. And also, like, that I was curious about, but also I was trying to find something beneath this thing. But he was very diplomatic and I was an asshole. And what ended up happening was that, and this happens with a lot of podcasts, despite how much you hate the person I'm talking to, or whatever you think of Carlos Mencia or Robin Williams or Dane or any of these people, Ben Stiller, it doesn't matter, that what happened because of my attitude was that, like, you know, I never really liked Dane Cook or even gave a shit, but you were a dick, and I thought he did all right. Like, he humanized him.
That's exactly the word I was going to use. You humanize these people that have become these caricatures.
Right.
Where
they represent something.
They represent something bigger, and then you're able to sit down because, number one, I think all these people probably respect and are slightly afraid of you.
Mm. And well, that's what he said. Dane said that. Yeah.
They respect you and they're slightly afraid of you. And so they just get really – they just get very human. And it's and I think as a listener, that is the best that you can possibly do when you're interviewing someone is humanize them and and get their story out of them. And I thought you did a great job, and it made me kind of like Dane. And I didn't really care about his material or not. I'd had a couple experiences with him that were negative, and so on a personal level, I was like, "Eh, fuck that guy." But hearing what you brought out of him kind of made me go, "Oh, well, maybe I was being a dick, and he's just a dude."
Well, the weird thing that I started to realize, like, I don't ever set out to do anything when I interview, other than have a conversation that is organic. You know, so whoever I'm talking to, you know, we sort of forget that we're on the mic and we talk. But the thing I'm learning from talking to all these people is that, yeah, the egos of people that have that much stature are going to be fairly daunting, you know, and even if they're, you know, acting beneath their ego or they're trying to be like, sort of like, I'm just a guy. And I'm like, you're not just a guy, really.
like Leno, I'm just a working class stiff caught in the machine. Like,
right.
Well.
Yeah. But then you start to realize that that's there. So like, how do you engage in that moment where where I brought up the essence thing, which somehow or another threw him a curveball because, you know, he had not prepared for that or that I would know that story. And I wish I'd know more about the story, but the fact that he couldn't really deal with it.
But you were hammering him with that so hard. You said it like 15 times. You were like, but did you steal my essence?
Yeah,
and he was like, all right. I mean, I don't know.
Right, right. Well, but the thing was, is what was interesting in that moment was he couldn't muster up a sense of humor about himself in that moment. And every time I brought it up, he did not. you know, he would not muster up, like, you know, like, yeah, I did say that, or, you know,
because it was probably, it's an embarrassing thing to have someone hear you say, you know, like, because you, you know, it's just one of those things. That of a million things that you say in a day, some stuff that comes out of your mouth is going to be stupid, you know, like just
no. But I, understood the idea of essence,
yeah.
You know, and I call it drive shaft.
Yeah.
And it just was just interesting to me that the reason I kept hitting him with it was really touchy, and I'm like, and it wasn't like it was that sordid or that weird or that, you know, controversial a moment, but like he clearly said it, and he had an intention of it, and just characterizing him as this guy standing over Hollywood going, someone is taken my essence. It just struck me as interesting that he couldn't, you know, he couldn't get humble about it.
Right. I sort of read it as that he was just embarrassed by it. Like, that he was just like, okay, I can't. I don't know.
He was very nice. He sent me a bunch of coffee. Like he sent me like 20 pounds of coffee because I'd offered to give him some coffee because I have a coffee sponsor, and he invited me to his house. And you know, I really struggled with the idea of, like, you know, maybe I should go over to Dane Cook's house, because I have this idea that, you know, he's got no friends and that, you know, that he has sycophants around him. But I didn't go, and he never called me back.
I wonder, do you have, because I'm sure it wasn't your intention to do this, but now that you've sort of, I think you've sort of established at least some part of the podcast, there is a little bit of whistleblowing or taking people to task. Do you find that some of your listeners are more aggressive? Like, some of your fans are a little more aggressive than you would prefer? Like, if people come up to you at shows and like, yeah, and I went up to this one dude and I told him to fuck himself in the face, and okay, and that's not what I'm trying to get across here.
Well, a lot more of what happens in my listeners is I get a lot of people that email me that they thought they were crazy, and they no longer think they're crazy.
Okay.
That, like, somehow I speak to the inner workings of a brain, that my belief in terms of my monologues and stuff is that most of people's energy goes into just getting by,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, getting by in their relationship, getting by in their job, passing,
yeah,
you know, keeping their shit together. So they can't really honor the kind of existentially desperate monologue that goes on in all our heads. So I sort of share that. So I get a lot of emails of, you know, people like, I thought I was losing my mind, and, you know, thank God you're out there. You've really helped me through this shit. I thought I was alone. So I get a lot of that stuff, which is very rewarding. And actually, the guy in Bloomington, you know, my people are a lot like me in some of them anyways. Like, I sold pretty good tickets up there in Bloomington.
Mm-hmm.
And Jared comes up to me after the weekend and says, you know, you did really well with ticket sales, but I've never sold more single tickets. So... And I'm like, you know, that's my, you know, okay, those are my people. And another guy came up to me once at the Comedy Store and said, like, I saw that you were going to be here tonight. Like, I tweeted it or something. Like, I changed my plans because you're the fucking best, man. When I'm manic depressive, and when I'm depressed, I just listen to your CDs over and over again, and it gets me through it. I'm like, well, I'm wired for that. I mean, my dad was manic depressive, and he was my first audience. I mean, I was the kid that my mom would say, go upstairs and make your father laugh. You're the only one that can.
Uh-huh.
So I'm wired to connect to certain people. But that, I mean, obviously that's not all of them, because I have other fans that, because of the Mencia podcast and Dane and Robin, where there were really issues to be talking about, that, mm-hmm. that we were speaking about issues within the comedic community, you know, around stealing, you know, and around sort of like, you know, the reputations that these guys have. And I dealt with that. And then I have someone like Ben Stiller in, and then you get a couple of guys who are like, I think you went pretty easy on Stiller. I'm like, it's not 60 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I'm talking to entertainers. I mean, there was no indictment of Stiller.
Oh my God, I got that. And when we first started doing the podcast, people were like, you sure kiss your guests' ass a lot. Why don't you fuck? And I'm like, what? But they're my friends. Why would I bring them on and try to make them feel bad? We're just having a conversation.
Well, there's a delicate line with that stuff, because, like, in the circle that you run in, which I think is a little loftier than the one I run in, you know, just because you have more friends in the larger.
I don't know what circle do I run in.
No. I just mean that, you know, you have a lot more. I think, you know, real friends who are visible in show business.
Maybe. So I feel like a loner.
You want me to pull up the fucking, your episodes? So, like. All right. So, yeah. Okay, Mr. Loner. Can we give John Hamm a buzz? I bet you have his number on your phone. But anyways.
All right. Yes, we can call John Hamm.
Let's get Rob Zombie on. I'll patch him in.
All right.
Now, but all I'm saying is that because of that, and I had this issue with Adam Sandler once, is that as comedians, you know, depending what comedy, you know, what kind of comedy you do, if you're going to be a cultural critic, that the indicators of culture that show business represents is most of it in America.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point, you're going to be be in a position to attack a guy you know.
Right.
And you're going to have to sit there and you know, sort of deliberate over that. Like, you know, how do I, you know, I want to be, you know, make, you know, and this is something like, you know, when you look at someone like Andy Kindler, it's all he does. And because of that, you know, not only is he one of the best comics in the world, but he's a relative pariah.
Right.
So, you know, we're all conscious of that. So I think when people say you're kissing someone's ass, it's only because, you know, there's a politeness element that we maintain in some instances that is community etiquette.
Yeah.
And to people who are just listening, they're like, you know, the fuck that guy. They're on your team and they're like, well, he's not on my team. I don't like that guy. But in our world, it's like, well, we're in the same business.
Yeah. But I don't like to feel like I'm responsible for making people feel bad. I want everyone to be happy and I want everyone to have fun.
Why is mommy and daddy fighting? Well, that's an issue that you're going to have to deal with. Your codependency is like, you know, your own problem.
I can't disagree with that. But I loved, you know, when I was in New York in 2001 working on a show, and there was a lot of drinking going on at that time, and I remember I was doing sets around town, and I would hang out at the Comedy Cellar because I lived a few blocks from it, and I said to someone like, oh yeah, I'd love to go up to the Comedy Cellar, and someone was like, dude, don't even fucking try. You will never get in there. It is a close-knit thing. And then
the back table
of just, like you and Geraldo and
Colin Quinn
and
Nick DePaul, and Jim Norton.
Table full of assholes.
Yeah, yeah, on purpose assholes. Yeah, yeah. And they're going to, you know, run you through the ringer. I'm still get more shit than I can ever imagine possible when I go there.
Did you feel like that's what was happening there? Because you were on the other side of it. Did you feel like that's what it was?
You know, honestly,
or do you think we just read into that?
No. Honestly, I never was, you know, really integrated as one of the guys there.
Right.
I mean, the woman who now really runs the place, they literally, she would not put me on that stage and give me spots until she saw my HBO half hour. That, like, you know, I'd been doing comedy 8 or 9 years. All of my friends worked there. But she also runs a room that's, you really have to work there. You can't fucking, you know, noodle around in that room.
Right.
It will get quiet really quick. It's a room that is so humbling that I can go there and still have a set where I walk off saying, you know, I know how to do this, right? I mean, I've been doing this a while. But I was never part of this core group, and it was always very clear, you know, if I'd go to New York and I'd say I put in spots, and she'd be like, I don't know, you know, Geraldo is here, Attell is in town, Mark Cohen is back, you know, so like I'd be the guy that even if I'd come out of town and I hadn't been there in 4 months, you know, I'd get one spot on the Saturday, and you really sort of want, I used to really want to just get, you know, like two or three on Friday, you know, three or four on Saturday, so I could just hang out and eat and, you know, have a nice time in New York. But I was never that integrated, maybe for a few weeks. So
wow, that's amazing. It's just so amazing, the perception that, and I think you, it's just like what you said to me before about, oh, the circle you run. I think we always have these ideas of how, like, where people are with, you know, like their situations or their groups. But then most of the time, if you ask them, they're like, really? You thought I was a part of that thing? I'm not a part of that thing. I didn't really know any of those people.
Well, I hung out there a lot, but I never felt like, you know, like I could always go to the Cellar.
Yeah.
You know, and work.
Yeah.
You know, I never really felt that. But, you know, I used to sit around there a lot. But then it got to the point where it's like, I've been doing this long enough to where I don't really have to, you know, why do I got to put up with this shit? You know, what am I going to, you know, I'm going to sit there with a bunch of dudes who are my peers, you know, and I'm certainly at the same level they are. And I'm doing the 12:30 on Saturdays, and I got no other spot. So I'm going to sit there and eat. And talk and go, no, I'm not, I'm just going on, and I got one. So I just stopped doing it.
Well, what's incredible is that whenever I go to New York and I can do like two or three shows in a night, I'm like, oh, that's right, I forgot. There are places where, just because in LA is almost like a barren wasteland of, you know.
I just hear, I'll go to the Comedy Store even if it hurts me, only because, you know, it's not cool. There's no industry there. And, you know, you just get up there and slug it out and you work out. And then I'll go to alternative rooms. Like I'll do Tiger Lily. I'll do shows that people ask me to do. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll just book an hour at UCB just to work out shit.
Yeah.
And you find ways. And now I got a lot of road work coming up. I just taped my new CD in Brooklyn. But a lot of the building I'm doing now, I don't care where it is.
Yeah.
Anymore. And, you know, I never go to the Improv. You know, I never go to the Laugh Factory, just because it's like, I'm just at a point where it's like, I've lived this long without them. Why do I got to jump through hoops for fucking, you know, Jamie Masada, who like acts like a douchebag to me every time I see him for reasons I don't even understand? What do I got to do that for?
Yeah, well, I mean, you just call them a douchebag, so maybe...
He said he acts like a douchebag.
He acts like one because he is one.
Dude, oh. I mean, I was just there with Madrigal, and Madrigal, you know, reintroduced me to Masada, who I've different points in my career, I've worked there on and off.
Yeah.
And he goes, you know Marc Maron, right? I keep telling him what a great club this is. And Masada goes, yeah, you keep telling him what a great club it is. So
maybe,
I mean,
maybe he'll come true.
That's clearly acting. Like, I didn't say that. I chose to say here on a podcast that he'll never listen to that he acted like a douchebag. And I think clearly that indicates acting like a douchebag.
Which is fine, because I think the last time I went up at the Laugh Factory, like once a year, I'll go, maybe it wasn't as bad as I remember. And I'll go up and have a set that just feels like I'm trying to walk through a swamp with ankle weights on.
Well, yeah, but see what you just said, walking through a swamp with ankle weights on is good training. So like on some level.
Well, let me tell you why. When you hear, no, the last time what always happens is I end up going up, like the last time I went up at, it was Dom Herrera was doing a show. Yeah, Thunder in fucking Los Angeles.
God damn it.
Dom Herrera was
It'd be amazing if this slid down the hill while we're in it.
we'd get it. As long as just hold the equipment to make sure you catch it all.
They'd podcast it to the very end.
Yeah. Do you guys get it?
We're podcasting under rubble. They're removing rubble.
Yeah. Someone
we're
please
okay.
release this.
We're okay, Jonah, you okay?
No, I'm good. Make sure this gets uploaded before I die.
So, Mark, you don't have the use of your rotator cuff anymore. Do you feel like...
I'm good, man. Guys,
I have feeling in my leg again.
Oh, good.
Success.
Well, what happened was the last time I went up there was probably like 2 years ago, and Dom Herrera was hosting a Tuesday night show, and he was like, hey, come on down, do it, it's fun. So I show up.
Was he the comedy judge?
No, he was not a comedy judge. He wasn't. He decided not to show up that night for whatever reason.
Sure.
My name wasn't on the thing.
Yeah.
So they were like, oh, okay, so we'll put you up. So I was supposed to go up at like midnight on a Tuesday, and then Dane shows up, and then he does like an hour 15. Like, he just showed up and then did an hour 15 of not really anything. He was just kind of fucking around. And
look at me time.
By the time I went up, it was like almost 1:30 in the morning. There were maybe 20 people there spread out. They keep all the lights on at the Laugh Factory like it's a lecture. And it was just awful. Like, I had an awful time.
Well, the thing about where I'm at now, and it's like, look, you know, there were times in my life where, working at the Improv was so important to me. Working at the Comedy Store was so important to me. Working at the Comedy Cellar, like, I just, that's all I wanted. And there's part of me that still wants all that. But the truth of the matter is, you know, I have to acknowledge my place in the fucking business. And no matter how much I want, you know, carte blanche or to be able to work regularly at a place, you know, we live in a world full of, you know, 20,000 comics, and everyone's got their agendas. There's politics to the business, there's club politics and everything else. And at this point in my life, I know that I can get my work done in any number of ways. Yeah. And I cannot be hung up on that shit. And it just hurts my feelings and my fucking pride to be, you know, to be expected to jump through hoops or to be underpaid.
Right.
And it's just like, when it really comes down to it, I just say to myself, I've lived this long without it. Is this going to make, you know, why am I fucking, you know, allowing myself, you know, to go through this, you know, relative humiliation? I paid my fucking dues.
Well,
dude.
And now you're in that sort of camp of people who are just kind of carving out their own thing.
Yeah,
which I think is, you know, I think part of the hard thing was that, you know, you developed, and you were at a time where comedy was sort of like live comedy was sort of kind of dying down a little bit. There wasn't really, like, now we can easily promote stuff to people and put stuff out in the world. And it just, you didn't have that in the early
days. Yeah. And I didn't really do it until, you know, this started to happen. I had no idea how effective or what it would do.
I remember, the three of us were at a show at the House of Blues in that little side room.
Oh, yeah.
I think this might have been the night that George Carlin died, actually.
Really?
It might have been. But, like, I remember, like, Chris was on stage, and we were talking off to the side, and I remember you were having one of those Marc Maron freakouts where it's like, you know, you had to complain about something, but not, and I was closest to you. Okay. And you're just like, it's like, yeah, I don't know what I'm doing, man. My fucking career's plateaued, if that. And then, it's like, you know, I got nothing in the works. Like, yeah, I got nothing going on. And then, you know, like... you know, cut to, you know, the podcast again starting.
Out of pure desperation. Anytime I've made any sort of movement in my career, it's been either out of, like, all-consuming spite or absolute desperation. Yeah. And it was not, like, it wasn't some sort of plan. You know, it was like, God, I hope this fucking works because I'm going to lose my house.
Yeah, well, that's like, you know, you under similar circumstances, you started this podcast.
Yeah,
you were just at a place where you're like, "Fuck it, I just want to do my own thing."
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I'm it's been one of the best things I think I've ever done because it's fun and I like it and people.
And you found your place. It's the weirdest thing is that, like, even if I started when I did, I'd never fit in ever. You know, I was always this sort of like, "Well, Marin does that thing he does." Yeah, so it was never I was never an easy fit, and I never understood that comedy was a business. I just, you know, I expected, like, I just need to go up there and be seen and you know, express my philosophy of life, and everything will unfold. I never thought it was important to be part of a group of comics or have relationships with people on the other side of the
or
business,
learn how to be a marketer
or a marketer, or have good relationships with club owners, respect the staff. I was completely self-involved, and it's a gift. I mean, like, I don't know what would have happened if my podcast, you know, hadn't, you know, if people hadn't liked it. I don't know where I would be with, you know, or how I would feel, but I do know that I've put in the time to, you know, I know that I'm capable. So, like, I know I've paid my dues, and that's not coming from a bitter place. So when anyone asks me, you know, I really have to sort of think, like, you know, well, we need to you to do this first. I'm like, well, what the fuck is that? And do I really need to do that? Yeah, in any situation.
Oh, okay. I guess not.
Yeah.
I think it's just funny that so many of us feel like we're not where we want to be, or we're not doing well enough. Like, even last night at this Doug Benson show, Pardo and I were like, they, you know, Doug started introducing everyone, you know, Patton Oswalt, crowd goes fucking bananas, Josh Molina, crowd goes fucking bananas, Sarah, Pat, you know, Paul F. And then Pardo was up next and he was like, now watch the applause die. And but when he went out, they fucking loved him. And it was just, it was such a perfect moment.
Who's Josh Molina?
He was on Sports Night and West Wing, and he's an actor, really funny guy, nice guy.
Well, Pardo's like he's one of the funniest guys alive, and he's a little nuts with the insecurity, and I think I am as well. But the interesting thing to me is that I'm completely bowled over that people, like, dig this thing, that, you know, dig, you know, my podcast. And it's like, I had no anticipation of it. I'm not gloating in it. I'm just sort of like, oh my God, really? You listen?
I think what's shocking about it is because it feels like it's, maybe it's just because we have this idea in our heads of, well, you know, when a large studio or company pays you to do something, then you have a job and a thing and a career.
Sure, there are parents.
And because we're doing something that is something we would just do anyway, just talk to people about shit that's interesting, it feels like we're not doing anything. And you're who you are. You're just as purely who you are as possible. So when people respond to that, what is really happening is they're saying, hey, I really like you. And that's weird to take. You're like, well, really? I feel like I'm not doing anything.
Well, no, but that's it. That you know, I know that if people listen to the podcast, they do know me.
Yeah.
And that, like, this is the first time in my career that I've actually been able to be as much me as possible. I do disagree a little bit in that it's a lot of work.
No, it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's my job, yeah. You know, the podcast. But I love doing it because of the freedom we have, and that you have all these weird choices that you never had before, and you have this audience. I never had, I don't think I've ever had this many people, you know, have direct access to me.
Yeah.
You know, on a regular basis and send me things.
Where do you think we would be? Do you think the insecurity is necessary? Do you think it's a necessary motivator? Do you think it drives us? Like,
no.
What if we didn't have it? Do you think we would still be?
Well, I don't, like, I'm trying to figure out whether it's, I guess it's insecurity or it's some sort of, you know, I don't exactly know what it is. And I don't ever feel like when people say that my comedy is neurotic or it's introspective or it's too heady. It's like, I don't see it like that. I think I'm being, you know, very uplifting and that I'm celebrating life. But in terms of my own problems, where would I be without my problems? I don't know, because I get to that point. Like, there was this risk a few weeks ago before this relationship I was in ended, where I was getting a couple emails saying, like, Marin's happy. You know, I don't know what's going to happen to the podcast. And of course, I said, you know, I really think there's trouble around the corner, so don't panic. But I don't hold myself to that same standard. I just think that the insecurity, I think everybody wants to be respected and everybody wants to do well at what they do. And not knowing that you're doing well, or my bigger fear is, Like, I get to the point where it's like, how am I going to fuck it up?
Right.
It, like, I'm not so much
of... the sabotage gene.
Right, right. In that there's that fear that, like, it's the screw's got to turn, and they're going to stop liking me.
My dad had that. My dad had so much of that when he was young that he's developed this idea that, well, every time something good happens, something bad's going to happen. Like, he connected those things together, so it was very hard for him to be happy when he was young.
Well, yeah, but I think that, like, I'm trying to get away from looking at everything black and white in the sense that, like, you know, life, you never know really what's going to fucking happen. And a lot of times, like, it's very easy to get, to get, the insecurity reveals itself where you start looking at comments and doing this, and then, you know, somebody says something that a troll says something that obviously they know you well enough to trigger a sense of insecurity, and then I got to, you know, talk to a friend who I respect and go, did I really just and they're like, no, dude, he's just fucking with you. But it's kind of true, right? Like, I want, there's some part of me that wants to feel that kind of, like, you know, to feel that anger of, like, you know, fuck you, I've been, you know, and I just have to make choices around that shit and not respect my instincts.
Well, you can be in a room of four 400 people are laughing, and you see one guy in the fourth row who has his arms crossed.
Yeah,
and you're
problem.
Like, what's that guy's problem?
But
what's
you know
that
what?
Guy's problem?
Well, you think it's with you, but they could, like, who knows? Their cat could have died that day. Like, 90% of the time, what they're doing is they're not paying attention because whatever their fucking life or whatever, you know, burning house that they just walked out of to come to your show is still, you know, prominent in their head.
Yeah,
and then you always risk the fact it's like, why are you sitting there like that? Well, my mom died. I'm like, oh fuck, I had to talk to the audience, you know. So
but a little bit in your head
home.
As a comic, you think you're like, it's like no matter what happened to that guy today, I should be good enough to make that guy laugh,
right?
Still.
So then you choose to talk to them, and then you choose to engage the troll, you choose to do all these things. Really, it's really out of your control. But, you know, if you can get a room full of people to laugh at his pain publicly, then you've really achieved something great. That means you're a great comic.
Yeah, which side of the yeah, because I always think, and I always had you in mind when I thought about this, because I would say, I used to, and I think I said this on your podcast last time too, where I said, I think good comics relate to the audience well, but great comics can force the audience to relate to them. And I think you said, it's not about forcing anyone to do anything. Was your response?
Well, the thing is like, what I start to realize is that as I get more vulnerable on stage, is that the best that can happen is you become sort of a group mind. Like, you know, I'm not looking to get high on laughter. I'm looking to be heard and seen and feel that connection that we have.
Yeah.
And, you know, an indicator is obviously laughter, but sometimes with my shows, like, I get a weird sense of warmth. And then if an audience member starts talking to me, I don't have any problem talking to them, because in that moment, you know, you're going to be more vulnerable than you're going to be in anything that you're just generating in your head. So, you know, a lot of times when I got off stage, the best moment is when I think somebody said something in the room. Like, a lot of times I'll think I'll hear things, which is fucked up. Like, you know, did somebody just say that I'm an asshole? You know, and then it's always like, you know, I'll write it out for like 20 minutes and I'll get off stage and it's like, no, that dude was talking to the waitress and he was asking for a drink called an asshole. And then I just did 20 minutes, you know, as if I'd been called an asshole.
Oh, good thing he didn't order Get Off the Stage, Marc Maron.
Well,
it's
a
great drink, though.
Well, that's on some menus at comedy clubs.
Yeah, it's a little bit of vermouth and
cigarette ashes.
So is that a picture of Bill Hicks there?
Where?
Is that Hicks?
No, that's my old first promo shot.
Are you serious? Because the glasses, your face is mostly covered up.
Yeah, that was when I was doing a John Lennon thing with the, like, you know, sort of, I got my hand glasses on my head and my real glasses and my sunglasses. That was my very first sort of comedy shot.
Ari Shaffir wrote something the other day on Twitter. He was like, be honest, people, has Bill Hicks ever really made you laugh? And I wrote back and I was like, yes, of course he has. He wrote the joke about why he was, I think it was on Revelations or something, where he talked about why he dated a 19-year-old girl, where he referred to her vagina as a wisp of cotton candy above a paper cut.
Yeah.
And then when you flip her over, her something about her...
Oh, the bunny?
Like winking like a rabbit's nostril.
Yeah.
Which was one of the most brilliant descriptions there.
So no, of course not.
Yeah. Where do you... just out of curiosity, where do you think he would be... had he not died, like, in terms of with this whole digital revolution? And
oh, no, I think he would have had, you know, the audience he deserved, and I think he would have, you know, he would have done what he did, which is shine a lot of light on the, you know, the hypocrisies and also the he was a guy that really could eloquently speak truth to power in a very vicious, beautiful way, and I think that he would have just, you know, continued to build that. I think that he would have been one of the only people alive that could, you know, really assess and take on in a lyrical, eloquent way, you know, how we are all being fucked
right.
by the powers that be. I mean, you know, it's a shame what happened to him because obviously because it is because he died, you know, he's too young, but that his voice was sort of it was a real life force, it was like a sort of a force in nature. And it's sad, you know, even if you didn't laugh at him, that he had that great capability to make you completely shift your perception of something. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the real sign of a great satirist or a comic is that, hey, I never thought of that like that. And holy fuck, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, he had the capacity to blow minds. And I think that, you know, that's, you know, lacking. I mean, you know, what people think is mind blowing is, you know, is that how did that cat get across the pool with those shoes? You know, like, or whatever. So
YouTube.
Yeah, exactly. That, you know, he was a mind blower and, you know, and he was a fucking brain raper. And that's good.
Well, I think also you have to contextualize what he was doing with the era that he was doing it in. Like he was the complete antithesis to the whole like comedy boom, you know, like all those.
Yeah, but the thing was is that like his type of voice, or you know, when people say, you know, people who do what you do, like not that I do what Hicks does, but there's a certain path in comedy that only a few people will take because, you know, ultimately it's not the fast path. It's not rewarding. You may not become a star, but you have to honor your voice and your heart. And so, like, whether or not, you know, comedy was whatever it was at that time, no matter what time, you know, Hicks would have appeared on the scene, he was going to be difficult for a lot of people. But I think because of what you're saying, because of the ability to find your audience and to utilize self-promotion, you know, it would have been a lot bigger. But, you know, he was, you know, an iconoclast.
Well, yeah, and I think, what does put you guys in the same boat is that there's a difference between, like, I catch myself all the time, like, how do I write a zinger on the end of this bit? Which is an entirely different approach to comedy, which is, how am I going to go up and talk about things that are real and true? Which is different.
Yeah, but Hicks was Hicks was great at writing zingers, you know, and in a way, you know, in his way,
yeah.
That he was great at turning a phrase. You know, I think you can see some of his, like, you know, he had a style of lyricism that, you know, you still, you know, I mean, you know, Patton's got a little bit of that,
yeah.
In the way that, you know, you take words and you kind of, you know, build words into like some sort of Rabelaisian explosion,
yep.
You know, just this lyrical thing. But I think Hicks was a very, you know, articulate and meticulous writer. So I think you're giving yourself a short shrift on that. And in that, you know, that more so than me, you know, I'll certainly fly by the seat of my pants more often than I will compose something because I'm so, like, I need things to be so immediate. But I think he definitely wrote the fuck out of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're about at the end of our hour. Actually, we're about an hour 15, which is perfect.
Okay.
Perfect amount of time.
So is there a theme song or anything that we sing?
We say something about enjoy your burrito at the end of each podcast.
Did you just say it?
I think maybe I did.
Did you bring burritos?
No, we didn't bring burritos. It's a metaphor.
We had burritos before we came here.
We did not enjoy them.
You didn't enjoy them?
No.
Ed, that Senior Fish isn't as good as the other ones.
Oh, you should go. You got to go to Cacao. Up on Colorado, Cacao Mexicatessen.
Oh yeah,
you guys are literally going to enjoy your burritos.
Why? Thanks for having me.
I am so thrilled that we were able to get you on, and thanks for letting us use your equipment. And you know, honestly, if you ever have a fallout last minute, I will absolutely.
No. We'll do it, dude. We'll do it. You know, we'll do it.
Also,
it doesn't have to be a fallout.
To any listeners that I'm sure most of our listeners already listen to the WTF pod, but like if they don't, they really should check out the entire catalog.
WTF pod. You can follow Mark Maron, M-A-R-C, M-A-R-O-N on Twitter, or at WTF pod as well.
No, I didn't take up too much space here, did I? I mean, I didn't. I it was your show, right?
You were perfect.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
You're absolutely perfect.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.
Enhance your listening experience with Wondery Plus. Enjoy ad-free listening, exclusive content, binges, and more. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.